We're continuing our series called The Last Days, as it prepares us for, as we prepare for Easter, rather. So we are going to be looking today at a time of sadness. Last week we had a time to be together, and Rose really helpfully opened that whole idea of the way that the disciples did come together prior to this terrible time that Jesus was about to go through. And now we come to a time of sadness. So we're going to read Matthew chapter 26, starting at verse 36. I'm going to read it, and then we will reflect on these on this part of the preparation for Easter. So we are looking at Matthew chapter 26, verses 36 to 56. Then Jesus went with his disciples to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to them, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." He took Peter and the two sons of Zebedee along with him, and he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me." Going a little farther, he fell with his face to the ground and prayed, "My Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me. Yet not as I will, but as you will." Then he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. "Could you men not keep watch with me for 1 hour?" he asked Peter. "Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the body is weak." He went away a second time and prayed, "My Father, if it is not possible for this cup to be taken away unless I drink it, may your will be done." When he came back, he again found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. So he left them and went away once more and prayed the third time, saying the same thing. Then he returned to the disciples and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Look, the hour is near, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go, for here comes my betrayer." While he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, arrived. With him was a large crowd, armed with swords and clubs, sent from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them, "The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him." Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, "Greetings, Rabbi," and kissed him. Jesus replied, "Friend, do what you came for." Then the men stepped forward, seized Jesus, and arrested him. With that, one of Jesus' companions reached for his sword, drew it out, and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. "Put your sword back in its place," Jesus said to him, "for all who draw the sword will die by the sword. Do you think I cannot call on my Father, and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? But how then would the scriptures be fulfilled that say it must happen in this way?" At that time Jesus said to the crowd, "Am I leading a rebellion that you have come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Every day I sat in the temple courts teaching, and you did not arrest me. But this has all taken place that the writings of the prophets might be fulfilled." Then all the disciples deserted him and fled. I think it's just such a powerful the way the story builds and the way this whole thing is building to an incredible climax. We have to be so careful, don't we, with the parts of the Bible we know the best, that we don't actually lose the impact of it, that they must have lived through it. We know the end of the story. They didn't. So we come to this time of sadness in that reading that we've just read. I wonder whether any of you recognize that film. Hopefully you do. How many of us remember the classic music? Can you make the noise? And they say, sadly, when that film came out, there was an upspike, or an uptick, I think the Americans call it, in attacks on sharks. That actually sharks became, you know, sort of like the horror creatures of the sea. And there were more attacks against sharks. Admittedly, sharks do it, particularly, you know, big ones like that do attack people. But I just think that I remember watching that film. Now, it came out in 1975. So I want to say that my parents didn't let me, I was 10. I'm sure my parents didn't let me watch it when I was 10. I would have been utterly traumatized to have seen that film when I was 10. So I'm going to make a wild guess. It was later when I was old enough to see it. But I still remember my reaction. Now, let me see if I can get the story right. One of the main characters, there was a police officer. There was like a sort of guy who was a marine biologist, and then there was a guy who was like a shark hunter. And I think it was the marine biologist. They'd heard that somebody went missing, their boat had gone missing, and they were looking for it. And they thought they saw the wreckage of a small boat in some shallow water. And so the marine biologist, can't remember the name of the character now, but he's played by Richard Dreyfuss, and he dives in the water. He's got a pair of goggles on. He dives in the water and goes down to the wreck. And he finds in the side, he looks at this wreck, trying to work out what's happened, and he sees in the wreck, at the side of this boat, there's a great big hole in the wooden hull of the boat. Does anybody remember what the jump out of your skin moment is? That happened when he looks through the hole in the boat. Anybody tell me? Sorry? An arm or a leg? Not an arm or a leg. Even worse than an arm or a leg. The bloated face of the guy. It's like it sort of falls in the boat and falls into this hole. And it's like it's looking at him. Well, I remember watching that. And I tell you what, my fingernails were in the ceiling. I was just absolutely petrified. Now, the reason I'm telling you all that is not to scare you, but rather to remind us that so much of the fear factor in watching a film is in the anticipation. You know what I mean? It's sort of, so much of the fear is about the fear of what's going to happen rather than what has happened. But I do want to say to you in all seriousness, rather than horror as a film genre, today we're thinking about genuinely horrible experiences. We have to be so careful, don't we? We don't see all of life through the lens of as though it's all a film or as though it's all something that's on the screen. It's strange, isn't it, that we can watch a film about, I don't know, some sort of terror attack, but I hope we can differentiate between something like that and what we're seeing in the Middle East, as we see bombings of homes, as we see families being destroyed. I hope we can make that differentiation between a horror film and what true horror looks like for families, for communities in various parts of the Middle East and other parts of the world. Part of the problem here is that, of course, the headlines about the Middle East drive other headlines into the back pages and perhaps even out of our news altogether, that they don't get reported. And genuine horror is not something that we can simply encapsulate in a two-hour movie. So we're thinking about genuinely horrible experiences, particularly experienced by Jesus in these verses. And so there was, for Jesus and for us, as we read these verses here, there was a genuine feeling of foreboding. Something is coming. We don't quite know what it is, but it feels as though we are heading towards some sort of climax to this experience. There's a sense as though this is not going to finish well. There is a collision between Jesus and the powers that are against him that is increasingly unavoidable. It feels as though these are genuinely, this crisis, this coming together, this collision is coming. And so this feeling of foreboding, in many ways, it builds up to what we get in the following chapter. In Matthew chapter 27, we have Jesus, when he's on the cross, crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? You know, I think that must have been the first time that Jesus ever experienced that sense of total separation from his Father. Elsewhere, particularly in John's Gospel, Jesus says some amazing things like, I and the Father are one. The intimacy and the closeness between Jesus and his Father God was so close. And yet, when we reach this moment of climax, we have that sense that Jesus has, where have you gone, Father? Are you still with me? And I think this is a powerful sense of this drawing towards this unavoidable climax. So we have this growing sense of horror in this passage. It seems as though the cruelest time of all is now. Like we said, anticipation is so often the awful time. Here Jesus knows what is coming, and so he says to his disciples, my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. I know what's coming, and I don't want it. But I think it's unavoidable. And so we have this awful choice that lies before Jesus. This awful choice. Jesus prayed, my Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me. He didn't want to go through it. Sometimes we present it as though Jesus, almost without emotion, walks to the cross and accepts it. He loved life. He loved life so much. He didn't want to give up his life. But he said, not as I will, not as I want. I realize that it has to be as you, Father, want. The agony of his decision-making here is real. We mustn't turn it into some sort of thing that was inevitable. Jesus had free will, as each one of us have free will. Jesus chose to die. He chose to give his life. He chose to fulfill the plan of his Father. It's interesting to see that actually, As God's son, he senses his father's perfect plan. As the son of man, he knew in his human sense that he didn't want to die. But as the son of God, he senses and recognizes the perfect plan of his father. He has authority to overrule it. He has authority to overrule it. He says in verse 53, "Do you think I cannot call on my father and at once he will put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? Do you think that if I asked, the Father would not take me from this?" But Jesus chooses to go through with it. And I think we have to assume that if Jesus said, "Lord, I don't want to do this," that the Father would have allowed him not to go through it. Otherwise, where is Jesus' free will in this? It had to be Jesus' choice to go through it. But he knew that if he said, "Lord, not your will, but mine," that our salvation would have been lost. The need for a perfect sacrifice, not of a lamb, not of an unblemished lamb, but actually of a sacrifice of far greater significance spiritually, the sacrifice of God himself in his son, if Jesus had not gone through that, we would have no basis for our reconciliation with God. Now, I think we can't pretend we fully understand this. We don't. But I think we can thank God for it. Because if we hadn't received it, where would we be? I find it amazing that Jesus three times prays, "Lord, please, if it's possible, let me not have to go through this." He has an awful choice. And then we have this sense of abandonment. A sense of abandonment. Not just spiritual abandonment, as we've seen, as Jesus says, "Lord, please, if I can avoid this," but also a very human sense of abandonment. Jesus said to his disciples, "Could you men not keep watch with me for 1 hour? That's what I was looking for from you. I needed your support. I needed to know you had my back. And you couldn't even stay awake for that." I think it's easy to be hard on the disciples. They were exhausted. It's weird because I don't think they properly knew what was coming, but all they knew was they were bewildered. Things are happening at such a pace and they weren't sure what was coming next. And I think to myself, how would I have been? I think I'd have been asleep on the floor, just trying to recover from these events that were quicker and quicker and quicker and not knowing how to cope. So I think I'd have been one of the ones that Jesus said, "Could you not keep watch with me 1 hour?" You see, for Jesus, friendship was a total commitment. If you were a friend, it wasn't sort of, "I'll be there if you need me, I may not be. If I've got something else to do, I'll probably do that instead." For Jesus, friendship was a total commitment. In John chapter 15, verse 13, Jesus says this, "I no longer call you servants, for a servant doesn't know his master's business. Instead, I've called you friends. For everything that I learned from my Father, I've made known to you. Imagine that depth of friendship, that everything Jesus learned from that intimate relationship that he had with the Father, everything I have learned, I share with you. That's what friendship meant to Jesus. And therefore, in this moment of great need, when Jesus needed to know that his friends were there for him, and I guess he knew, in some senses, he knew what they were like. He knew just before this, of course, he had said, the Son of Man is going to die. And then Peter initially said, I'll never leave you. Whatever happens, I'll be there for you. And that's when Jesus says to him, when the cock crows three times, you will deny me. And all the disciples came in, no, I'll never leave you. So Jesus knew, but I'm going to guess that in his humanity, to see them there, sleeping, as he wept, or we understand sweated drops of blood. I understand that actually it is physically possible to sweat blood if you are in a terrible state emotionally. It is possible. He wanted them to be there to help him, to carry his burden in his most desperate time. I want to show you a picture that we used to have this picture up over the dinner table in our house. And it's by this German painter, Sieger Koerder. There should be what's called an umlaut, two little dots above the O of Koerder, so it's pronounced that way. This picture, I think, is very powerful and speaks in lots of different ways. Can you see whose perspective the picture is from? It's from the perspective of Jesus. That is Jesus' hands. He has one hand around the cup, and the other hand, potentially maybe touching maybe the bread, or maybe just his hands around the cup. Can you see in the liquid, the wine, Jesus' eyes looking back? I also find it fascinating, the faces of the disciples around the side. See the looks of fear, the look of confusion. They don't know what to make of it. Some of them are looking at each other. They've even got their fingers in their mouths. They're just not sure what to make of it. And can you see there's a character right at the back on your right? Can you see there's just someone going out of the door? Any guesses who that might be? Judas. Going out into the darkness. Out into the darkness. Can you see the bread on the table? Now you may be able to see the cross over the top of it. Can you see the way the bread is broken up? Do you recognize what that sign is? It's called the chiro, and it's basically a letter P with a cross, but across that way, straight through the middle of it. It is the first two Greek letters that spell Christos, Christ, and it was used in the early church to represent Jesus' identity, his authority, and his victory. So here this man, Sieger Koerder, is using the symbolism, and he's saying, this bread broken this way represents not just my body broken, but my identity, my authority from the Father, and the victory that will be gained through my broken body. Ziga Kurder himself is an interesting man. He only died 11 years ago, 2015. But he was a German Catholic priest. But before he became a Catholic priest, he had actually fought in the Second World War. And he was captured and held in a prisoner of war camp. He became an artist, first of all, and then became a Catholic priest. And it's interesting, some of his artwork is just amazing. And I have actually quite a few copies of this, so one of these Easters, we'll look at some of those pictures in more detail. But his work is full of symbolism, so that it isn't just a picture to look at, it's a picture to look at in depth and see something new each time we look at it. So, this represents this sense of Jesus, his broken body, and the sense of the disciples being so confused. We also have this frightening purpose to all of these events, that Jesus is going through all of this for a reason that must have been just so, confusing for the disciples. Jesus says, right at the end of the reading we read, this has all taken place that the writings of the prophets might be fulfilled. Even in this moment of crisis, as he is grabbed, as one of his disciples, we think it was Peter, cut off the ear of one of the people come to arrest Jesus, even in all of those moments, Jesus hasn't lost his sense that this is for a reason. That actually, even though it feels as though this is chaos, the Father's plan is still in effect. Jesus still recognizes that this is happening for a reason, for a purpose. Time and again, Jesus deals with an impossible present, what is happening now, by understanding both the past and the future through the scriptures, through the lens of the scriptures. Earlier, in verse 31, Jesus had said, "Strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered." It was before our reading today, so just a few verses before that, but this sense, "Strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered." Those words, he was quoting directly from the prophet Zechariah, and you can find it in chapter 13, verse 7, of that fairly short, one of the minor prophets we call Zechariah. "Strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered." Jesus knew that in the moment of crisis, the disciples would literally scatter. They would run off into the darkness. They would leave him abandoned. But interestingly, immediately after this verse, Jesus points to the hope that lies in the future. He says, "After I have risen, I will go ahead of you to Galilee." And the Bible quite clearly tells us the disciples had no idea what he was on about. The Son of Man's going to rise. When you rise, you're going to meet us in Galilee. They couldn't cope with it. They couldn't work out what was going on, what he meant. It only became clear to them afterwards. But you see, even here, Jesus knows that he has to go through this incredible pain and anguish, but actually when he comes out the other side, there will be a victory that couldn't be achieved any other way. The suffering of the Son of God was also the suffering of the Father God. We think of Jesus' suffering so often, don't we, on the cross. We have to remember the Father God also suffered. Don't know how many of you read this book, Long Walk to Freedom by Nelson Mandela. I remember distinctly reading it. And in one chapter of that book, Nelson Mandela talks about one of his hardest realizations. He cites one of his hardest realizations. He says, "My attempt to serve the millions of South Africans I would never know or meet was at the expense of the people I knew best and loved." Sorry, at the expense of the people I knew best and loved most. It was as simple and yet as incomprehensible as the moment a small child asks her father, "Why can you not be with us?" And the father must utter the terrible words, "There are other children." And for Nelson, he had to say, "I have to put the millions of children in South Africa above my own children." And now, the likelihood is we will not be asked to make such a monumental choice. But it does remind us that the Father had to put his own son, his own son's needs, after our needs. He put us first and knew that his own son had to choose to make this ultimate sacrifice. As painful and as unwanted as it is, it's as though Nelson here is saying, "I must sacrifice what I would love to have, the years of your childhood. I have to give those up to other children in order for them to get what they need, their freedom, their dignity." I want to finish just by looking at these words of this famous, well-known song that just occurred to me as I finished preparing for this. How deep the Father's love for us, how vast, beyond all measure, that he should give his only son to make a wretch, to make me, to make you his treasure. These are the most important words that I want to think about right now. How great the pain of searing loss. The Father turns his face away as wounds which mar the chosen one bring many sons and daughters to glory. But those words there, the Father turns his face away. I think to Jesus, it felt as though for the first time in his life, the Father had turned his face away from him. But from the Father's perspective, I like to think that the Father turned his face away because he couldn't face looking at the anguish that his own son was going through. I just like to think that the Father was so broken by what his son was going through that that's why he turned his face away. Not out of disgust or out of shame, but out of his own love for for his son.